McCloskey Speaker Series. You have a lot of friends, Bonnie and Tom. They were filling up the room. Steve thought it was for him, but I said, no, the McCloskeys have lots of friends. And so thank you all.
The truth is, Walter was saying when we started, I said, Steve, I'm actually surprised that many people came out to hear you speak on such a beautiful day. I said, thanks, Walter.
We go way back, Steve and I do. Steve, when he founded AOL, early on, I was at Time Magazine, and we made some deals with them. Steve then parlayed that into a takeover of my company without asking, which was also fun while it lasted.
Fun for you, maybe. But.
but one of the important things about Steve is that in the early 1990s, I don't think any of you in this room are old enough to remember the early 1990s, but you could actually not go online as a regular, normal consumer. You had to be at a research university or a Department of Defense lab. But what you could do, and what we started to do in 91, 92, you probably started it earlier, was online services. And whether it was AOL or CompuServe or Prodigy or Delphi or chat boards like The Well, they were really great communities. Steve, when he took over AOL, realized that it was about community, communication, bringing people together. In some ways, in the 92, 93, 94 period, some of that was blown away because the web came along and everybody just started publishing on the web. But what I like to think, and what Steve's book, The Third Wave, touches on, is that now more and more people are able to get involved in this, and we're returning to the notion of community. So his book, The Third Wave, I see John Edwards back there of Explorer Bookstore. He'll be selling and signing. But I want to start by asking you, why did you write the book, and what lessons were you trying to convey?
Well, first of all, it's great to be here with Walter, who I have known for 25 years. That's when we first started talking and working with the Time Inc. At the time, he was the digital editor of Time Inc. I don't think they knew what that was, but he was pushing things, including working with us. And then we went public a year later, and then obviously a bunch of years later did the merger with AOL and Time Warner. And since we've worked together on a variety of other initiatives, and when we were coming back from a conference in Aspen last fall, I had given him a early version of the book, and he went through it with his suggestions, and suggestions coming from Walter about books you have to take pretty seriously. And he also agreed to write the foreword for the book. So when he asked me to come here to talk about the book, it was a quick yes, and it's great to see so many folks here. In terms of the reason I chose to write a book now, and frankly have resisted writing a book for a couple of decades, is I feel like this next wave of innovation, what I talk about as the third wave, is going to be remarkable in terms of its impact on our lives and some of the ripple effects in society. But it's going to require a different mindset, I think, and a different playbook. And some of the lessons from the first wave will be applicable in the third wave. So therefore, the book for me is, while there's some kind of historical aspects to it, some lessons learned from things we did right and things we did wrong, there's some aspects of that. For me, it's mostly a book about the future. I should just set it up briefly in terms of what these waves are. The first wave was just building the internet, building the on-ramps to the internet, getting the world connected to the internet, which, of course, we all take for granted now. But when we started AOL 31 years ago in 1985, only 3% of people were online, and they were online an hour a week. So not many people knew about it or cared about it. Even those who knew about it didn't really think it was that important. By the end of that first wave, pretty much everybody was connected and started having a pretty significant impact on our lives. The last 15 years or so, the second wave has basically been building apps and services on top of the internet. So it's Facebook and Twitter and Snapchat and Waze, all the different things I'm sure many of you use. But it's basically been about software. And I think the third wave is going to be integrating that internet into education and healthcare and transportation and energy and food and a lot of aspects of our lives. But some of the things in that first wave around partnerships, some of the things around policy and regulations are going to become important again in the third wave. So that really was, I've been talking about these things for a number of years, felt it was time to write a book that is about the future, but part of that future is informed by, you know, a perspective on the past.
One of the reasons the book is so good is that it is about the future. It has a lot of ideas, but it also weaves in memoir, weaves in story. We're just talking to somebody from Williams College, but you go out of Williams College, and if I remember correctly, you're at Pizza Hut, other places like that, and you feel the need for connectivity. Tell us the story.
Well, actually, the story starts with Alvin Toffler, who passed away a few weeks ago, who wrote a book in 1980 called The Third Wave. So when I decided to write a book, I deliberately used the same name, and I pay tribute to him in the book, even provided a blurb, which I appreciated for the promotion of the book. But when I read that book, I was a senior at Williams, and I was completely mesmerized by what he was suggesting, which essentially was, in his three waves, where the first wave was sort of the agricultural revolution, the second wave was the industrial revolution, and what he was predicting, and this is now four decades ago, was that his third wave would be the technology revolution, the digital revolution. The internet didn't exist then. Consumers were not using interactive services, but he was talking about this. I remember reading that book and saying, I know he's right. I know that's going to happen. I want to be part of it. But when I graduated in 1980, there was no internet companies to go to yet. It didn't yet exist. And there, frankly, wasn't a startup culture back then. So that led me to work for a couple of big companies, Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati for a couple of years, and PepsiCo, which at the time owned Pizza Hut. So I was the director of new pizza development. Yes, that was me.
And now there's an app for it.
Yeah. Traveling around the country, eating pizza, and getting paid for it. But meanwhile, I was learning about the personal computers, learning about online services, learning about modems, and finally decided in 1983, I'd been only 2 years at P&G and 1 year at Pizza Hut, to move to the Washington, D.C. area to join a startup that I thought was going to be the right way to kind of pursue this. And it promptly failed. A few weeks after I got there, they laid off like 70% of the staff. So it's like, ooh. The startup stuff is sometimes a little scary, a little risky. But thankfully, two of the people I met there, Jim Kimsey and Mark Seraf, and I then co-founded AOL in 1985. So it was a little bit of a circuitous journey. I kind of knew where I wanted to go. I kind of knew what I wanted to do. I couldn't quite figure out how to get there until 1985. But even there, as you know, it took us from the time we started in 1985 about a decade before we broke through. Most of you probably did not know what we were doing or care about what we were doing or know about the internet till probably the mid-90s, mid to late 90s. And the best evidence of this is when we went public in 1992, as the first internet company to go public, we'd been at it for 7 years, and we had 184,000 subscribers. And then 7 years later, we had 25 million. So it was a lot of basic building blocks to put the infrastructure in place, build the awareness, build the partnerships, time and others, before it kind of finally broke through.
Those basic building blocks, though, included something that CompuServe, Delphi, and others didn't do, which is it should be simple. It should be friendly. When you get on, it should say, you've got mail. Where did you come up with that notion of making it for the rest of us, not just for the geeks?
It was a mix of things, but I think the passion I always had, and I think our team had, was about how do you democratize access to information? How do you level the playing field so everybody has access and everybody can watch or read or different views, but also everybody can express their own views. Remember back 30 years ago, Time Inc. and New York Times and CBS, there were a few major media outlets that really controlled the dialogue, and making sure everybody had their voice could be heard was important. So trying to level that playing field, so accessibility became important. We wanted everybody to get online and not just have it be kind of for the technologically sophisticated or the elite. And we knew the only way to do that was to make it super easy. I used to say that the rallying cry was we need to make this easy enough for my mom to use. And she always hated that I said that. She said, why don't you pick on your dad? I'm way better at this than he is, which was true. But it made the point that we're trying to make sure, we want to get everybody online. How do we make it as simple as possible? How do we make it as affordable as possible? How do we, you know, just make it as fun, make it more engaging? So that ease of use was a big driver. And the other you referenced was we always thought that the killer app was people. It was community. Other people were focused on content, particularly media companies, or connectivity, the phone companies, or commerce, the retailers, all of which obviously were important. But we said, no, the most important thing is community. It's people. And so we always invested in people connection, instant messaging, and what became texting and other things kind of grew up. Over half of our traffic, our usage, was always these community functions. And it's not surprising to me that now with Facebook and Twitter and other things, that's still front and center. This longing to be connected, still is something that is a pretty powerful notion. The technology might change, the brands might change, but that idea has remained pretty consistent, across the last few decades.
And when you came up with this concept of what we now call social networking, which is being part of a chat room, an auditorium, a bulletin board system, or a community, it was a mix of people had their handles, you might be Walter Rabbit 3 or something, but you were known both to AOL and kind of known to that community. You had a reputation. So there was not pure anonymity. You also had moderators. And so the discussion in the chat rooms, bulletin boards, and comments, people had to be civil and straightforward. That has now been lost totally, whether you go to Twitter or Reddit or anything else. Do you think it would be good to get back to a notion of community where there wasn't total anonymity and you kind of trusted and knew the people in the community?
Well, I think there's a mix of things now. And Facebook, for example, you do know who's doing on Facebook, and you're following people that are friending people in that case that you know, and they know you. And so there is that aspect. And there are other services, Reddit is a good example, where there is more anonymity. I actually think having both available is a good thing and a healthy thing. And people can then decide which things they want to use or which things they want to use for different purposes. But in those early days when we were really trying to educate people about the idea of being online, the idea of the internet, we basically were trying to do everything we could to make it as easy to use and to create that sense of community. So the screen names, we called them at the time, basically were persistent. You could say it's Walter I, or you could say it's Walter 2678, or whatever you wanted to. You could be either identified or more anonymous, but whatever it was going to stay with you. That name was going to be persistent.
And do you think now that digital technology, online, everything else has helped to bring us closer together, or is it balkanizing and hurting our political discourse, fracturing us a bit?
Well, both. I think the evidence is both. I think absolutely these technologies have connected us in ways that weren't possible before, both connecting to people we already know and care about, family members and friends and so forth. It is easier to be connected than it was 30, 40 years ago. So that is a positive. You also have the ability to essentially meet people you otherwise never would have met, and that's a positive. That sense of community was not just how do you connect or stay connected to people you know, but how do you meet other people you don't know but should know because you have some shared interest or passion. That's been a positive. What's been the negative is that there is this dynamic that has been talked about. Some people refer to it as filter bubbles, where people tend to follow people who share their perspectives, and therefore they're reinforcing those perspectives and not really exposing themselves to the other side of the argument. That aspect, I think, is unhealthy, and it happens on television. People watch certain networks that reinforce their views, and it also happens on the internet and Twitter and Facebook and other things. You're basically generally, if in Facebook, for example, you're following people that are your friends, in most cases they'll have some, be able to share some common perspective, and the things that they're posting, therefore, for the most part, will be reinforcing your views, not challenging your views, or at least exposing the other side of you. So that's aspect of it has been, I think, disappointing, that instead of being that connector that it gives people access to people and ideas all around the world they otherwise wouldn't have access to, which is still possible for many people, they're not really taking advantage of that aspect.
You mentioned that when you came out of college, like when I came out of college, there wasn't a startup culture, and the default was you joined Time Incorporated, Procter & Gamble, PepsiCo, whatever. Now there's an entire paradigm shift where very few corporate entities exist, but people have to be entrepreneurial and people have to be part of a startup culture. How are you seeing that affecting a new generation when you go around the country and see sort of the creative culture that's popped up?
Well, I think it's terrific that this, I talked earlier about part of the idea of the internet was leveling the playing field in terms of access to information and ideas and people. The aspect that I worked on more in the last decade is how do you similarly level the playing field in terms of opportunity, including opportunity to be an entrepreneur, and how do you try to make sure everybody with an idea has a shot at the American dream? And that is, you know, more challenging in some parts of the country than obviously other parts of the country, but it's important to kind of push that. But in general, it's easier to be an entrepreneur now than it was 30 years ago. There's a culture in many places, not all places, but many places that's supportive of that level of risk-taking. And as a result, there are more new ideas that can improve how we think about health or education or food or some of these, you know, sectors than would have been possible before. I think that is the positive. And so we've sort of democratized access to opportunity and to entrepreneurship. That said, and it's part of going back to your original question, part of the reason I wrote the book, I actually think that this next third wave is going to require far more partnerships between the small companies and the big companies. And the reason for that, in the second wave, when it was just about software, Facebook actually didn't need partners. They just needed a great development team to create a great service that spread virally, and suddenly they're, you know, kind of truly an overnight success. But if you really want to revolutionize healthcare, it's actually not just about the app. It's how you work with, like, doctors and partner with hospitals and connect with health plans and deal with some of the kind of regulatory issues. If you really want to kind of revolutionize cities and transportation and energy and smart cities and a lot of things that people are working on, it's not just the software. It's how you establish the relationship with other companies and city governments, other things that are going to be, you know, part of that. So I think that's going to be the tricky dynamic in this third wave. I think the startups have to grow up a little bit and recognize it's not just about them. It's also about a broader idea and needs to be more inclusive. And the big companies need to figure out how to be more open to working with these young, crazy entrepreneurs. Not always young, by the way. I think you'll see generally older entrepreneurs in the third wave than the second wave for a whole host of reasons. But how do you build a bridge between those two worlds? Right now, there's kind of a divide. How do we build a bridge so the startups get the benefit of the market access or the, you know, the credibility or the understanding of the policy issues of the larger companies, and the larger companies get the benefit of the innovation happening in a much more rapid pace generally in these small companies. So we need to build that bridge. And we also need to build a bridge, frankly, between Washington, D.C., and Silicon Valley, because there's also a divide there, that there are going to be more challenges as we move into this third wave that's going to require more constructive engagement, which is why, you know, things like the Aspen Institute are so important to be those platforms for bringing people together and discussing complex issues. There's really tough issues that we're going to have to deal with in this third wave, and it's not going to happen if people are basically kind of in their silos, you know, hunkered down, you know, kind of just focusing on their side of the equation. It's going to require more engagement with partners and more engagement on policy.
Both for President George W. Bush and now for the current administration, you, to some extent, you and Jean, your wife, have been very, I don't even know what party you're on, but you've been very nonpartisan.
Then it's working.
Yes, very nonpartisan and very much helping to connect Washington policymakers, not only to tech, but to entrepreneurship and startup. Why has it been so hard for Washington to speak the same language as the tech companies and the startups and the entrepreneurs?
Well, I think it's a different culture. It's a different mindset. I mean, in general, you know, people who are in government, whether it be elected officials or in different kind of agencies, are there for different reasons than the people working in startups or working in large companies. They generally have a different mindset. I think they all generally have the best of intentions, but how they pursue those and what their priorities are a lot different. And certainly on the regulatory side, you know, most regulations are put in place probably all regulations are put in place because something bad happened, and we're saying we want to make sure that bad thing doesn't happen again. So they're generally focused on avoiding bad things happening. That's kind of what their role is. Obviously,
is that counter to entrepreneurship?
It's totally counter to entrepreneurship. And you know, obviously, the entrepreneurs are trying to imagine a new world and new possibilities, and it's more the art of the possible. And so figuring out ways to strike the right balance so you aren't just keeping bad things from happening, which is an important role, but also unleashing a dynamic where good things can happen, that aspect's important. I do think I give the Congress and the White House credit four years ago now, they passed the Jobs Act, the Jumpstarting Our Business Startups Act, that basically updated securities laws that hadn't changed in 80 years, and to make it easier for people to use the internet to raise money, something called crowdfunding, make it easier for young companies to go public without having the same kind of regulations of, you know, the Fortune 500. And that happened because the parties came together in a bipartisan way and said, while there are risks associated with things like crowdfunding, there, you know, startups are risky, and people investing in startups, sometimes they'll fail and people will lose their money. It also democratizes access to the opportunity to invest and the opportunity to be an entrepreneur. And so it can enable things to happen. And, oh, by the way, most of the job creation comes from young, high-growth startups. So we want to, you know, boost jobs and drive the economic, you know, kind of growth side of the equation. And we've got to figure out ways to unleash more of that, you know, good stuff. And so that's an example where it doesn't ignore the downside, doesn't ignore the risks, but says on balance, we need to lean into the future and need to figure out how to enabling the good stuff to happen, not just protecting, you know, the bad stuff to happen. And that's going to become more complicated in this third wave as we, you know, that some of these sectors are kind of ripe for disruption.
You're very close friends with Senator Mark Warner, who was just here at in Aspen, talking about in this new type of entrepreneurial gig economy, we need a new type of social contract. I mean, my pension and sick leave benefits stayed with me at Time Inc., you know, the entire time, but we don't have a system that allows the mobility that entrepreneurship should have. What are your thoughts there?
No, I think he's right. This notion of the very nature of work is changing, and it's going to change more in the next, you know, decade. The model when I was growing up, like my dad worked for one organization, a law firm, for 60 years. You know, that was the model. You know, basically get a job, and you know, if, assuming things were going well, you'd kind of stay with that, you know, forever. When I came out, I mentioned I had like three jobs in 3 years. Of course, my parents were completely freaked out by this. It's like this guy's not going anywhere. Can't even keep a job. But that was the, you know, the nature. Well, now there's some people who work for two or three companies in the same day. This gig economy, Uber and Handy, there are many companies, you know, doing this where you're essentially, you know, creating a more modular approach to work. And there actually are benefits for all the players. It gives the workers, in this case, much more flexibility. They work when they want, don't have to work when they, you know, don't want. Gives the consumers more flexibility and often, you know, better value by eliminating a middleman that was, you know, often taking more than half of the, you know, the revenue. But it also creates some challenges. And so right now, even in the Labor Department, they track, you know, full-time employees, and they track essentially part-time employees. They do not track this gig economy, or what some have now called the flexible economy. So that is an example of something where policy will become more important. And Senator Warner is one of the leaders who's really been, you know, kind of pushing that agenda. And exactly what those rules are, don't know. Exactly when they go in place, I don't know. But recognizing the nature of work is changing, and we should reflect our, you know, kind of adjust our policies to reflect that new reality is exactly the kind of thinking we'll need more of in this third wave.
You say the nature of work is changing. We also said a moment ago that it was in the second wave where a Facebook had come out of a dorm room, and now you can't just come out of a dorm room with a biotech or life sciences company. What does that mean for how we should educate your kids, our kids? What should we be teaching?
Well, you know more about this topic than, you know, I do, and probably anybody in the room does, but I think it is important to encourage people that have a interest, a propensity to move into some of the STEM subjects to do that, but not everybody has that inclination or should do that. The skill sets, I think, will become even more important going forward in this third wave is the ability to think differently, think out of the box, creativity. How do you you know, imagine a new world, connect the dots in different ways? That's fundamentally what entrepreneurs do. They just it's sort of pattern recognition. They're seeing this and seeing this and seeing this and saying, maybe this is going to come together and that's going to happen, and how do I get organized to, you know, to make that happen? It's out-of-the-box creative thinking, and as you know, because of all the work you've done with, you know, Teach for America and other things, the general view of teachers I talk to is most kids start pretty creative in kindergarten, but by the time they graduate from high school, we beat a lot of that out of them. So how do we figure out ways to, you know, inspire them to continue to be creative? Some of the core, you know, skills around, you know, communications and being able to analyze information and synthesize it and be able to communicate also going to be more important, particularly if partnerships and policy becomes more important. It's not just about the coding. It's not just about the software. There's some you know, broader skills that are important. So I think it just says that you need diverse teams that bring a diverse mix of skills to bear. And if you're just focused on one side of it, you just have, you know, great engineers, for example, you likely are not going to be successful in this third way, because you're going to miss, you know, some aspects that are going to be very important. And the other dynamic, and there's a lot of debate about this, particularly in Silicon Valley. The general view in Silicon Valley is that great innovation happens because the people thinking about the problem or the opportunity are not saddled by any historical baggage. Basically, by knowing nothing about what you're about to do, you can imagine a new world in ways that people actually doing it would never imagine. And there actually is some truth to that.
Like,
and
Uber, for example.
Uber or PayPal, the founders, you know, said if they had worked for a credit card company, they wouldn't have imagined the way it PayPal. So there is that aspect to it. But there also is an aspect, I think it's become much more important in the third wave than the second wave, that having domain expertise is going to matter. Understanding the rhythms and cultures of schools or hospitals or how to figure out ways to establish a partnership with the Cleveland Clinic or United Health, or how to engage with mayors around issues around regulations and policy. That's going to require a different kind of approach, a different, you know, kind of, you know, mindset, and having some credibility in that sector and some network in that sector likely will become, you know, more important. So bridging those worlds, not being so wedded to the, you know, the nature of how things work that you're kind of looking in the rearview mirror and you're missing the broader trends, that's a mistake. But at the same time, I think this notion that, you know, kind of ignorance is bliss and naivete is a competitive advantage for entrepreneurship, while it worked quite well in the second wave, I think it will work a little less well in the third wave and will require a more kind of blended, balanced, nuanced approach to innovation.
You mentioned a moment ago about the democratization of opportunity, that this has allowed opportunity for more and more people. But at the Fortune Brainstorm conference that's going on concurrently, if you run across people on campus, that's what they're here for. One of the big issues has been how surprising the digital divide has been persistent and made it so people, kids born in certain zip codes, just weren't able to get the opportunities, and their lack of opportunity has widened between the rich and the poor, the privileged and the not, because of digital technology. How would you fight that?
Well, I think it's true, and it's not just true in terms of the digital divide. It's also true more broadly in terms of sort of an opportunity divide. The data here is not encouraging, and right now the playing field is not leveled in terms of place. It's not leveled in terms of, you know, people and a diverse mix of entrepreneurs. Now, last year, 75% of venture capital went to three states, California, New York, and Massachusetts. 75%. 50% went to Silicon Valley. And I don't think there's, other than people in Silicon Valley, many people who think that 50% of the great entrepreneurs with great ideas are all in those zip codes. They actually are all around the country. But for a whole host of reasons, mostly historical reasons, venture capital has been centered in the San Francisco area, and most of the investors focus in investing in that area. And it's a great area to invest in, and will continue to be a great area to invest in, but you've got to level that playing field so people all over the country who have ideas can actually get the capital to start and scale those companies. It's worse if you look beyond place and people. Last year, over 90% of venture capital went to men, less than 10% to women. Does anybody here think that reflects the distribution of, you know, great entrepreneurs with great ideas? About 1% went to people of color. So it's actually not fair. The playing field is not level. And so people do feel left out. They do feel like the American dream is not available to everybody. So some of the initiatives like crowdfunding were designed to, you know, help deal with it. Some of the initiatives we're working on, like this Rise of the Rest initiative, is trying to promote regional entrepreneurship to try to kind of level that, you know, that playing field, so that the playing field is level, whether it be around access to information, things around the digital divide, or also access to the opportunity. I led a task force a couple years ago for the University of Virginia that was around entrepreneurship, and basically the title of the report are, you know, can startups save the American dream? Can, you know, we figure out a way to give that sense of possibility and that opportunity to everyone, everywhere? And I think, you know, we have a lot of work to do to accomplish that.
You're trying to help accomplish that through your Rise of the Rest tours, which are quite amusing because you get on a real bus and you bring people around.
In New Orleans, we actually get on a Mardi Gras float with
yeah,
Walter.
We don't like, but yeah, we gave you a crown, right?
Yeah, I was like, you know, the king for the day, or
yeah, exactly.
Crew de new.
But what is the purpose of these trips? Where have you gone, and are you about to do, and are you looking to do another one?
Well, it really grew out of an effort that was launched in the White House about 5 or 6 years ago. It's called Startup America. The president asked me to chair. So I spent a lot of time traveling in the country just trying to understand exactly what we're talking about, what's happening in these different communities. And I was really struck by the momentum some of these communities had, but their stories weren't being told, and also struck by how fragmented some of the activities were in some of these communities, and feel like if there was more connections, more of a network effect, it would drive more opportunity for more people. So a couple of years ago, we launched this Rise the Rest initiative, which basically we just like rented a bus, and so we're going to drive around the country. And the first tour, we started in Detroit, and then went to Pittsburgh, and then Cincinnati, then Nashville. And we've done four trips and gone to places like Madison and Des Moines and St. Louis and New Orleans and Minneapolis and, you know, all kinds of, you know, St. Louis.
And people get to pitch ideas to you, which was cool.
Every day we basically try to use the bus as a convening platform, as you do here. And so we invite entrepreneurs and Fortune 500 CEOs and the mayor, the governor, university presidents to join us as we kind of wander around the city. And some of that is designed to create more of that network effect within the city. And then we bring media along to try to spotlight what's happening in each of these cities. Like in New Orleans, some of the things around education, technology, because of all the TFA teachers there and the fact that with your leadership, they kind of rebooted their school system and are more open to innovation than other parts of the country. Or Madison, Wisconsin, where there's a company, Epic Systems, that has 10,000 employees in electronic medical records, and now there's an ecosystem built around them. Or in Baltimore, Under Armour, which is based there, is building an ecosystem around what they're doing. Each of these cities has a little bit different story, and we're trying to understand that and help them tell that story with the goal of, over time, driving more capital to those cities so it is, you know, more level. And I don't know exactly what the number will be 10 years from now, but I know it's not going to be 75% in those three states. It's going to be more, you know, regionally dispersed, and this is just an effort to try to prod that along and try to encourage each of these cities to rally to support the entrepreneurs, and also, you know, kind of get more media in New York and San Francisco and LA and other places recognizing what's happening in Des Moines and Detroit. And it is worth remembering two things. One is that 250 years ago, America itself was a startup. It was just an idea. We're the leader of the free world now because we have the leading economy, which was not an accident. It was because the entrepreneurs led the way in that agriculture revolution, then led the way in the industrial revolution, then led the way in the technology revolution. If we're going to continue to have the leading economy, continue to lead the way, we need to continue to invest in and, you know, these entrepreneurs and lean into the future. It's also worth remembering that there's, as you know, as a you know, great historian and biographer, that there's an arc to these things. And Detroit, we deliberately went to Detroit to start off this first Rise of the Rest tour because 75 years ago, Detroit was Silicon Valley. It was the most innovative city in the country. 75 years ago, Silicon Valley were fruit orchards. Nothing. Detroit was everything. People were moving to Detroit. They're building schools and building libraries, building roads, building houses. And then It's more complicated, but at the core, kind of Detroit lost its entrepreneurial mojo, and in the last half century lost 60% of its population and went bankrupt. And it was Silicon Valley. So it's a reminder. Pittsburgh powered the Industrial Revolution. You know, it was challenged several decades ago. The steel industry was under a lot of pressure, you know, globally, has reinvented itself, and particularly around some of the things that Carnegie Mellon, robotics, other things, and now it's on the rise. Uber, perhaps the most visible Silicon Valley company of the last few years, is basically betting its future on Pittsburgh. They're building their autonomous vehicles, their driverless cars, in Pittsburgh because of the expertise in that. So these cities have, you know, expertise you can build on and cultures you can build on. St. Louis and Louisville, they understand farming. Like Monsanto, some people love them, some people hate them. They're in St. Louis. They have tens of thousands of engineers who actually understand agriculture technology. And will there be some interesting ag tech startups in Silicon Valley? Yes. But there are also going to be a lot in St. Louis and Louisville who understand agriculture, understand, you know, farming. But the entrepreneurs in those places do not feel like they have the same opportunity. And so some feel like, I guess I have to move to San Francisco or I have to move to New York. I'd really rather stay in St. Louis, but I need to feel like I need to move. And what we're trying to do is just allow any entrepreneur the idea to build that company wherever they choose to build that company and make sure we're celebrating entrepreneurs everywhere, not just in a few places, and make sure we have a more inclusive approach to entrepreneurship so everybody feels like they have a shot as opposed to a lot of people feeling like they're left out.
And it's had one of the most important, although little noticed, transformative effects since the move in the 50s to the suburbs, which is that whether it's Pittsburgh or Cleveland or Detroit, people coming back, the creative classes, the entrepreneurial classes, want to live in towns. And that movement back in towns is actually a great social transformation as part of what the third wave is about.
Yeah, and I think that you're seeing that in certainly the big cities. You're now starting to see it in these kind of second, you know, tier cities that really are being revitalized in part because of what's happening in the city, in large part what's happening with the entrepreneurs in those cities. And a great example, I mentioned my first job was P&G, and it was in Cincinnati. I was there for one of these Rise Arrest, you know, tours, and there was a neighborhood in Cincinnati called Over the Rhine, OTR, that 10 years ago was listed as one of the top 10 murder neighborhoods in the country. Scary place to be. Now it's the hottest neighborhood in Cincinnati with the hottest restaurants in Cincinnati in OTR, which 10 years ago nobody would go to. Why? The entrepreneurs moved in. They started building their companies there. Rent was lower. They kind of liked the vibe of the, you know, the community. There was a certain authenticity to it, and that drove more, you know, growth. As some of those companies were successful, therefore people say, "Oh, well, I might as well live near I worked," which drove growth in apartments. And people say, "Well, there are all these people working here and living here. Maybe it's an opportunity to open restaurants." And so it kind of got this whole kind of, you know, dynamic, you know, working. And that's now a very, you know, popular, you know, neighborhood. That's true in all these Rise Arrest cities. I'm sure you're many of you from different parts of the country. Almost every city I've been to has that, you know, story that a part of the city that was abandoned is now being revitalized, and it's often because of the entrepreneurs. 50 years ago, if you wanted to revitalize a neighborhood, the playbook was get the artists to move in, like Soho in New York. Now the playbook is get the entrepreneurs to move in, and then a bunch of other things start happening.
Let me open it up for questions, if I may. And I don't know, Bonnie and Tom, you're the great entrepreneurs. Do you have anything you wanted to? All right. Other hands? Well, yeah. And somebody's back there with a microphone. Yeah, Larry. Sorry, Tom, I didn't mean to put you on the spot. But
yes, I'm Larry Gelman, and it seems as though when I was of a certain age, the entrepreneurs were people like Ray Kroc and people like Howard Schultz and people who were coming up with ideas that I could understand. I mean, making a lot of hamburgers and selling them at a price, or a cup of coffee and getting people to be willing to pay $4 to it. It seems like today that unless you are technologically literate, if not brilliant, you're sort of out of the game, based on what I see going on at this Fortune Entrepreneurs Festival and what I see going on in the stock market in the real world. I mean, is that a fair assessment? And if so, is that likely to get even more so going forward?
No, I don't think that's fair. I understand why that, you know, might be the perception. And certainly technology, engineering, coding is becoming more important. I'd argue almost every company has become a tech company. There's some, Walmart, for example, is a retail company. Their investment in technology is unbelievable. You know, so, or airlines, you know, basically things you don't think of as tech companies really use a lot of technology. So that's why it's sort of the technology has kind of gone from being this sector, kind of a new kid on the block, to really being an underlying platform that, you know, kind of cuts across all businesses, cuts across, you know, society. So there is that aspect, and therefore technology is important. But I think the big innovations you're going to see in this third wave go beyond the technology, go beyond the software, and are trying to figure out ways to, you know, you mentioned Ray Kroc as an example. We invested in one company called Sweetgreen, expanding a fast, casual, healthier kind of menu concept. And they do use technology, both in terms of managing what's now a farm-to-table supply chain in a very smart way and allowing people to order on their phone. 25% of their orders are on people's phones. They don't have to wait in line. So there's a use of technology, but it's fundamentally about the food. Or in Detroit, when we were there on our Rise to Rest effort, we met a company called Shinola, which we made a big investment in. They're basically in the watch and leather goods business, but again, they use technology as a kind of core platform to, you know, to innovate. So I think you will see on the third wave, it'll be less about the core technology, less about the software in general, and as it moves into some of these other sectors that are pretty important aspects of our lives, like what do we eat and how do we move around and how do we learn, how do we stay healthy, it's going to have to go beyond the technology. But that's why this issue of partnerships is so important. I don't think, I mentioned in the book an African proverb that I think will kind of define the third wave. If you want to go quickly, you can go alone. But if you want to go far, you must go together. And so partnerships will become much more important. The last point, because you mentioned, again, Ray Kroc, who was, I think, 55 when he basically didn't technically start McDonald's, but he bought when it was one unit and then expanded it. I think the general perception, and it has been largely true, but not entirely true in the second wave, it has been more the dorm room startup dynamic, the 20-something dynamic. My guess is in the third wave, on average, you're going to see older entrepreneurs who do have some understanding about that sector and have some credibility in that sector to deal with partners, to deal with on the policy front. So I would not be, you know, quite as negative that it's, you know, only the technologists will prevail and only the folks, you know, creating stuff in dorm rooms will succeed. I think the third wave will be different than the second wave.
Right there, yeah. Sorry, the woman, yeah.
I'm Catherine Penn. Thank you for speaking here tonight. I'm an older entrepreneur myself, and I've worked for the last few years on an app. And when you were talking about finding funding and that only 10% of funding goes to women, I think it's even beyond that. And I actually wrote to you on Facebook about this a few weeks ago after you were on Mark Halperin's show. And I said that what I have found in living here, I've lived here for 24 years, I have a lot of friends that I know who invest in a lot of different things. And I personally don't have a lot of money, but I had a great idea. What I found was women relate to my idea in a completely different way than men do. So I have this app that's going to launch with my business partner, a woman, probably in the next month. But it's taken 3 years to move it forward because when you talk to a man, which most of the funding comes from men, you get this blank stare because the idea doesn't resonate with them.
So but how do we get venture capital to have more women in it, crowdfunding to have more women in it?
Well, crowdfunding, I think, is important. The reason that's important is if you look at the crowdfunding project sites like Indiegogo and Kickstarter, about 40% of successful crowdfunding projects are women. Yet, if you look at venture capital, it's 10%. That says to me, the playing field is level and really is about the idea, not just your network, who you know, or what school you went to, or something like that, then the playing field tends to, you know, level out. So that's why I was such a, and continue to be such a, you know, supporter on kind of the crowdfunding as a, one of those playing field levelers. But the other point you're making, I think, is very important, which is the great innovations will increasingly come from people who are closest to the problem. Whether in your case sounds like it's women or spend a lot of time including doing some investing in Africa and some of the things in rural villages in Nigeria, they have a different understanding of some of the challenges. They're coming up with remarkable solutions around, you know, solar energy and other things that people sitting in New York or San Francisco wouldn't even understand the nature of the problem or the opportunity. And I think that's and goes back to this third wave, because some of these sectors that are ripe for disruption are in the middle of the country, not just in California and in New York and Massachusetts. They'll be closer to that understanding, you know, that particular, you know, sector, and a lot of the innovation will happen there. So I do believe that the capital will follow the ideas, and over time the playing field will level. We're just trying to do what we can to accelerate that so it happens faster than it might otherwise happen.
I will say, the few times I've seen you on a Rise of the Rest tour and people in a community are talking, the biggest problem they say they face is the lack of a venture capital community. And so maybe if we can level that with crowdfunding and everything else, it would be helpful. Yes, sir. And then I think there was somebody back there, and I'll get you. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Mark Goodman, and I have a really good idea for a platform for podcasts, an auditory thing, which obviously I won't talk about here. But I'm clueless on how to develop funding, and every technology person I spoke to says, that's a cool idea. Where would one start to find funding and support?
I'd say funding is important, and maybe, you know, looking at crowdfunding would be something to at least explore and figure out. When there are now dozens of crowdfunding sites, including some that are focused on particular sectors. So depends on, you know, for example, there's one that just focused on consumer products. So if you have a consumer product idea, better to go to that one than some other one. So just learning about that would be important. But the other thing is to not be afraid to let your idea loose. What often entrepreneurs do is they think they have such a brilliant idea, they don't want to tell anybody about it. And I have two thoughts. One is, somebody else has the idea too. It's not as original as you think. And number two is, so don't be so worried about, like, it's such a great secret that you're giving away. Two is, ideas are nice, but execution is where it matters. You know, Thomas Edison, one of America's greatest, you know, inventors and entrepreneurs, you know, kind of famously said 100 years ago, vision without execution is hallucination. So good for you to have an idea, but ultimately, how do you turn that into like a business, a real product? And that requires socializing your idea, getting other people exposed to your idea, getting them part of your effort, your crusade to try to make that happen. So you know, as some of the things that have been involved in, like startup weekends, other things are designed to do that. How do you connect people with interesting ideas to other people and expose different ideas? And maybe, you know, at the end of one of these weekends, some startups form and some people say, I want to be part of that, you know, startup. But that would never happen if you're holding your idea close and not, you know, not telling other people about it. So I'd err on the side of opening it up. The way I look at it, when people pitch me, I get pitched a lot, and I ask the question, I say, well, you know, like, who's your competition? And most people say, I have no competition, which is a tell. And the reason it's a tell is because either they're lying, they do have competition, they're just not telling me about it. They're naive, they do have competition, but they don't know about it. Or it's not a big idea. If it was a big idea, somebody else is out there doing it. And then it's more a battle around execution.
Lots of hands, and we're going to do a lightning round. Yes, sir, and I'll get to you, but also a couple people in the back. Is that Pitchy?
No. Ken Ramberg. I started a company around the same time you did, not too long afterwards. What are your thoughts on the number of jobs that are going to be disrupted by innovation, robotics, driverless cars are one example?
I think it's a big concern. I think you cannot slow the pace of innovation. I think certain things will happen, and it'll happen on a global, you know, scale. So trying to slow that down, hobble the innovation to protect the status quo or protect jobs is not a workable strategy. But similarly, to just say, well, whatever's going to happen is going to happen, and it's kind of not my problem, is reckless and irresponsible. So I think what needs to happen is more of a focus around building companies that are creating jobs. And I mentioned Shinola. That was one of the things we loved about what they're doing. When they started the company, the purpose of the company was create jobs in Detroit and prove American manufacturing of high-quality luxury goods could happen in America. That was their goal. They've now created a couple thousand, you know, jobs. And, you know, they created that mission and then figured out what their product strategy is. There's a broader movement. I have a chapter in the book on it called impact investing, or purpose-driven companies that aren't just focused on profit but also focused on purpose. And some of them are measuring that purpose around job creation. One we backed in called Revolution Foods, and this, you know, it's focusing on healthy school lunches. They, too, have created a couple thousand jobs while also creating healthier options for kids in schools and a viable, valuable, you know, business. So having more entrepreneurs focused on that, more investors, you know, focusing on that is important. And then recognizing there are going to be some dislocations in society, and you can't just ignore those. You need to understand that. Even this election, which has been kind of a noisy, you know, kind of disruptive election, I think some of that is a lot of people are feeling angry and left out and feeling like they're being left behind. And so how do you figure out a way, you know, to make sure that's not the case? And part of it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about trying to be more inclusive and trying to be more sensitive on the implications of technology on people's lives.
Down here, I'll get Nick some exercise or just shout it out. Yeah. Well, here, no, he got here. Yeah.
Thank you. Enjoyed your remarks. 2 points I'd like to make.
We're into the last 6 minutes of play, so
that's all
lightning
right.
round.
That's all right. there's something, Steve, you didn't mention, and that is not startup, but scale up. I've made a career of scale up. My name is Shel Lubar. I live in Wisconsin. Very much involved with the University of Wisconsin. EPIC is an example of universities being a center of entrepreneurship. Silicon Valley, you could look to Frederick Terman and Stanford University that started it. And this is what's happening in the country. And the scale-up side is a little different than the startup side. It's a little less risky, and it's happening, and it's being taught. And we're teaching it in Wisconsin. And I think
I think that's a good point. Why don't you address the scale-up issue?
No, I agree with you. And we actually, at my firm, Revolution, have a group that's focused on venture investing and startups and growth investing, and we call speed-ups, which you also could call, you know, scale-ups, where there's, you know, there's more, the idea has been proven out, there's some clarity on the business model, but how do you scale it? And both are important. I think at the end of the day, how do you get more shots on goal? How do you get more stuff started? How do you level the playing field across the country so more things can get started? But then when you do see some that are showing that signs of a promise, how do you, you know, kind of surround them with mentorship and talent and capital and partnerships and other kind of things to take that idea to scale? So both are critically important.
Sorry, what was it? Yes, sir, right there. And then like this.
This on? Yeah. You had mentioned earlier the importance of having cooperation between government and entrepreneurs, et cetera. It seems there's a great deal of distrust between those two sectors. Most recently, I just think of the Apple-FBI battle. How do you rebuild that trust? And if you can, although it may be somewhat off subject, what's your take on that whole battle between Apple and the FBI?
Well, I think there is mistrust. I think there is a disconnect in terms of even people understanding what the other side they're trying to accomplish. And I think that there's a risk of that growing in this third wave. And so part of my, you know, again, part of my reason to write the book was, you know, a little bit of a playbook for innovators, whether it be startups or big companies, but also a little bit of a, some have called it a manifesto in terms of rebooting government itself so it can be able to deal with some of these challenges in a smarter, more agile kind of way. So I think as you get into some of these issues like driverless cars, there's going to be some really tricky issues around regulations, including on encryption. On the Apple, you know, case, you know, people like to be on one side or the other. I'm kind of in the middle, which I know is sometimes an uncomfortable place to be. I totally understand the view of the innovators in Silicon Valley, the risks associated with modifying their software to create what's called this backdoor that actually will have a lot of risk of unintended consequences that can be really bad, as well as chilling, you know, some of the innovation around their platform and maybe moving those platforms offshore. I understand that. At the same time, I think it's a mistake to not be at least listening to the arguments, in this case, the law enforcement's making, saying, you're actually charging us with, like, protecting your communities. You can't force us to unilaterally disarm, so we don't have the tools to keep, in that case, bad stuff from happening, whether it be terrorism, other kinds of things. Unless you're just basically say, you know, we're okay if bad things happen, and we just understand it's the price of living in a more complex, you know, society. Both have legitimate arguments. So the question is, how do you stop talking past each other, get some people in a room working on solutions, which I believe there can be, that allow you to kind of bridge that, you know, the divide. And that need for more discussion, more dialogue, more looking for solutions that kind of strike the right balance has become much more complicated in the third wave. So unless the government figures out a better way to do that, unless the innovators figure out a better way to do that, things are going to get worse, not better, you know, on that front.
I think that's in some ways a fitting in, because it is something that's missing in our society today, to be able to find that common ground with good discourse. We try to do it here, and I know you've done it for your whole career. Part of the reason that Bonnie and Tom do things like this is so that people like Steve can sell a few books and afford to feed his family. John Edwards and Explorers here, so if you have more questions, you can do it while he signs books. I see Mr. Wiley, who kept the Explore bookstore open for so long, for which thank you, so we can help Explore Book and Steve's bank account by going to buy books. Thank you.
Thank you, Walter. Appreciate it.